Welcome to the latest episode of Vox Talks Climate Finance with me, Tim Phillips, and hello to my co-host, Alisa Klein-Eyenhouse. Hello, Alisa.
Hi, Tim.
In today's episode, we're going to be discussing what the role of business schools is in sustainability education. And also, when those business school students graduate and they go off to join companies, what is the role of those companies that they join in society?
It is a great pleasure to host today Professor Peter Tufano. Peter is the Breaker Foundation Professor at the Harvard Business School and a senior advisor to the newly created Harvard Salata Institute for Climate and Sustainability. His current work focuses on business solutions to climate change. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks. It's great to be with you here today.
Peter, what has business school education traditionally been all about?
So I think we have to start by asking what the word traditional means. And I'd like to go back to nearly the beginning, more than a century ago, when the first business schools, at least in the United States, were set up. Their logic, their reason for being, was slightly different than what it was today. So this business school, Harvard Business School, when it was set up, the first dean had a very clear notion of what business education was about. It was about creating not only at the time, men who could go into business jobs, but also to create them with a sense of moral purpose, as well as a connection between business and government. In fact, there was an expression that was used at that time to describe what we were trying to do, and that was to create decent profits decently. So if you want to begin with a tradition of business education, then that's step one in the tradition of business education. Another part of business education, I think, picks up the story in and right after World War II. I've written about this extensively in a piece in the Business History Review. It's quite interesting if you look at how different business schools interpreted the role of business during World War II. Some of them saw that it was time to just shut down the business schools, and a number of them did that. But others decided that they would stay open because they thought that there were managerial skills that people needed in order to create the armaments and societies and keep everything going on at home. And in fact, if you look at modern business schools, some of our curricula has been really forged and tested and created in the midst of World War II. At that point, again, and I'll use Harvard Business School as an example, it was quite interesting because women were brought to the campus, minorities were brought to the campus, young people were brought to the campus. There was a sense of mission and a sense as well of requiring new ways of doing research and teaching. But it was a very mission-driven time in the history of business education. I think that largely continued through the early 60s. And so when you say traditionally, I suspect what you really mean is since the 1980s has business education been about. And there, I think, and I speak as a student of, more than a student, my thesis advisor was somebody named Mike Jensen. You may recognize that name from Jensen Meckling, an acolyte of the Chicago School. And I grew up with Jensen Meckling and, more importantly, Milton Friedman's view of business, which is that the business of business is business. That is a relatively recent view of what business is about, and also a more recent view of what business schools are about. And when I say recent, it kind of belies my age. But really, that's the last 30 years. And if you know that tradition, as it were, which is really not the tradition, it's the aberration from the long history of business schools, was about trying to stick to your knitting, to be anti-government, to say that, you know, basically make as much profit as you can, typically for shareholders. That's how it's been interpreted for the last few decades.
So in 2022, Harvard Business Review article entitled Business Schools Must Do More to Address the Climate Crisis, you explained that business schools can use their expertise for this purpose. So what sort of expertise lies within business schools to address the climate crisis?
Well, most of us don't have climate scientists. So we're not going to become the scientists of record for what's going on in the world. But we do have a lot of other skills. You know, in my field, and Alisa in yours as well, we know something about finance. We're going to have to mobilize, by some estimates, an incremental $3 to $4 trillion a year for the next 30 years in order to finance the energy and climate transition. It's going to require not only traditional finance skills, but new finance skills. In particular, how do you blend public and private financing? In particular, how do you use risk management in ways that are more innovative than ways that we've used before? So finance clearly has a role to play. Secondly, as we know, keeping track of things and creating metrics is important, not only in business, but also in climate. And so our colleagues in accounting have a great deal to contribute. We've seen greenhouse gas protocols in scopes 1, 2, and 3, but I think all of us would acknowledge that how we account for climate is an ever-changing subject, and our accountants can help us a great deal in that. Third, there's changes in operations that need to happen. We're going to have to fundamentally change how supply chains work and the guts of what happens inside organizations. Clearly, we have something to say about that. Our strategists study how it is that new business models are created. Well, there are going to be tons of new business models, so strategy is clearly engaged. And not that it's the last thing, but our colleagues study and teach about and try to train students with respect to leadership. I think the biggest shortage that we have in transforming our economies and societies to a more sustainable future is, in fact, the need for leadership. What does that mean? It means internalizing some of these big issues, turning them into action plans, motivating people to do things, and having sometimes the courage to act, despite the fact that it may not always seem like the most obvious thing to do. I frankly, can't think of a part of a business school that isn't involved in the climate transition. And that would be everything from undergraduate, if you happen to run undergraduate programs, to MBAs, and surely executive programs, because executives are on the front line of getting things done.
You're explaining why this fits with the long-term purpose of business schools. In the short view, the teaching has been somewhat different and focused on different things. Are you going to be able to teach about sustainability by telling people, we're giving you the tools, just apply them to this as well? Or is it going to require entirely new courses and entirely new focus?
I think it's both. On the one hand, what I'm not talking about is a wholesale rejection of everything we've taught before. And so a minor way of thinking about this is applying some of those skills to new sets of problems and new sets of opportunities. Mm-hmm. Business will find that the climate transition, the energy transition, creates massive opportunities for the creation of new businesses, massive opportunities not only to do well, but also to create value. Applying the traditional curriculum to this new set of problems and opportunities. But there is, as Tim, as you point out, there's another part that our students also need to learn. Those are things that we don't normally teach about. Some of those would include things like climate science, just a little bit, so that you understand a little bit of what, say, for example, these accounting measures are about, or you understand a little bit about why a transition plan that creates a large overshoot is problematic in terms of tipping points. So you need some of the science, but you also need a reorientation, which is not just about climate, towards that traditional, and I do mean traditional in the sense of decent profits decently, approach to business, which I think has always been there. And in fact, the research that we've done recently shows that this notion of decent profits decently, or I can use slightly more modern language to describe it, really is ascribed to by a huge supermajority of people in 28 countries around the world.
In the last few years, we've seen a great evolution in business school education and business school activities regarding sustainability. Could you give us a little bit of a reflection of how business schools have changed in the last few years and which business schools have done the most?
Well, I may not answer the latter one. Done the most, but I'd like to correct the question. I don't believe that most business schools have changed dramatically yet in order to address the issues that we're talking about. I think there are pockets within schools, and there are a few schools that have done more, but I don't think that any of us have done enough to really internalize the issues around how business needs to change and therefore how business education needs to change. We've made it a bolt-on. We've introduced in many courses little modules, but I don't think it is yet at the core of at least most schools. Having said that, I think there's lots of progress being made. Again, I'll just use Harvard Business School as an example since that's where I am these days. I'm right now teaching a course called Leadership and Corporate Accountability. It's a required course. The end of the course is a 3-day module on sustainability. So we had a case study first on Engine Number One's proxy contest for board seats at ExxonMobil.
Right.
And in addition to the corporate governance aspects of that, we talked a great deal about what that was about and in terms of the energy transition. We followed that with a case study on Aviva, which I just recently wrote, looking at how Aviva responded to the Bank of England's scenario exercise with respect to climate, but more importantly, how it is that their strategy, which includes an explicit call to systems change, is related to the problem of not just repricing risk or moving risk around in the system, but trying trying to reduce the risk of climate change. And we'll conclude this week with a case on Patagonia, which is not about the company, but rather about their new organizational or legal structure that makes, as they put it, the planet is their only shareholder. Earlier in the semester, we had cases on traditional energy and why it is that they were so committed to coal and why that's problematic. So in this required course, what we've done is we've included some, and I think, important material on climate. But I think that that's a great start, but we need to do even more. I know my colleagues at Oxford, we created a course called Global Opportunities and Threats Oxford, which, again, a required course, which brought this material into the curriculum. And my clarion call about all this is core values are expressed in core curriculum.
Yes.
Really a deep understanding of sustainability, not just the problem, but the solutions and the opportunities. We need to make sure that it's really bedded into the core curriculums of our schools.
I think that climate and sustainability are mainstream to any business. And for that reason, I think that it's not responsible for students to go through business school education without having learned about sustainability, that therefore it should be integrated in the core curricula, which is often not yet the case. For example, here at Cornell, it's mostly optional courses, which is great. But if either through climate change or the green transition, firms will inevitably be affected by the changing climate, I think students will have to learn about it.
Yeah, I have an idea for what might speed up this evolution, Peter. See what you think. If we provided incentives for the business schools to change their courses, and one of those incentives would obviously be in the ranking. Should we be adjusting the rankings of business schools to reflect how much they are teaching these sort of important topics?
So I have long-standing and quite public views about rankings without going into all the details. And having been the dean of a European business school for 10 years, where the primary ranking is the Financial Times, the notion that, I'm trying to remember the numbers, 43% of the ranking is a function of the salaries of our students when they graduate, puts an intense pressure on schools to ensure that their students simply take the highest paying.
Yes.
It also puts an intense pressure on schools to drive those students to geographies where the salaries are the highest. And I do understand that they're PPP adjusted. Rankings have many defects. Having said that, I'm going to give compliments to the Financial Times because they have tried to include more sustainability criteria in their rankings. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, what we have to recognize that there are six different psychographic segments of MBA students, and they have very different needs, and they have different demands. And the idea that a single ranking will tell all of them what's best for them is ridiculous. In the same way, if I simply said, what's the best car in the world? You'd say, well, wait a minute. Do you mean small economy car? Do you mean large luxury car? Do you mean SUV? And you say, no, what's the best car in the world? And in fact, that's what our business school rankings do, despite the fact that, you know, some students are explicitly coming for a return on investment, and you have to respect that. And others are coming because they want to have an impact on the world. So I've long believed that what we should do is to provide a lot of information to students, including information on what we're doing on sustainability, and then give them the ability to choose where they want to go, matching what it is that they hope to get out of the program. I wake up most days thinking about climate issues. I realize that not everyone does that. And there are students who are going to part-time programs and night programs and online programs. And quite honestly, their number one job is to improve their life and their family's lives. And I respect that. I'd like to make sure that all of them have some sustainability in them. But I'd rather provide a lot of information and move away from the idea of unidimensional ranking than try to tweak a ranking, which fundamentally has never been suited for purpose.
Here at the Cornell S.C. Johnson College of Business, where I am, I'm actually trying to give opportunities to the students to not only get opportunities to get well-paid jobs, but actually say, you know what, within that investment bank or within that asset manager firm or within that hedge fund, you might actually take on a job that looks at how that bank can invest more sustainably. So that would be a way, I think, to also merge sustainability and many students' objective for well-paying jobs, because ultimately what we know is that every firm in the economy has to go to net zero. So if you can actually teach students in the core, the typical jobs that they tend to take on, like banking, that actually they can make banks part of the solution, that could also be very powerful. You wrote that the urgency of the climate crisis demands that business schools experiment with new ways to quickly and effectively collaborate. Why do you think it's so important for business schools to collaborate?
Part of my research agenda these days is to study climate alliances. So we have a paper that will be coming out later this year in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, which is about why it is that firms have chosen to collaborate in the climate space. And the very first line, which comes from an interview from one of our participants, I think put it strongly. He said, if we could solve these problems by ourselves, we could. We can't. There are limits to how far you can get by working alone, whether that's a business or a business school. And what are those limits? We tend to have relatively small faculties in this space who are trained in this. They need to find ways to connect with their tribe, as it were. And while they do that, some of the times through conferences, to find even deeper ways. We have large bodies of alumni that we protect carefully so that we can raise funds from them. But they really need to be united with other bodies of alumni to make change. We need to create curricula, and often we don't have the capability to do that ourselves in a quick way. We need to reinforce one another's ambition. Sometimes people call these about ambition loops. I think all that are general reasons why business schools can and should collaborate. I speak from experience. Where schools do collaborate, more gets done. And I think that the people in each of the schools can do better work. So some years ago, when I was dean at Saïd Business School, I was studying and teaching about systems change. And one of the core tenets of systems change, if you want to change systems, you need to work across boundaries. It seemed obvious that if we were teaching this, we should probably do it as well. And so we created something called Business Schools for Climate Leadership, which at the time was a consortium of 8 European business schools working together. And rather than just being a champion of this activity, I actually joined it, along with faculty from my school and 7 others, and staff who run sustainability centers. And we've done some things. I'm not saying that they're earth-changing. We put together a climate toolkit. In and of itself, that doesn't make much of a difference. But what it meant was that we were forced to work together in a meaningful way. And we announced that at COP27. We've put together a number of another issues. I should say they, I'm no longer part of it since I'm no longer at Oxford. They've created not only a European group, but also an African group and a Middle Eastern group. One of the ahas was collectively across those 8 schools, there were 400,000 alumni who could be tapped in order to do things in the climate space, and who wanted to be tapped, and who actually were happy to talk to alumni of other business schools. So that was just a concrete way that that group was able to collaborate. Here in the U.S., my colleague Bruce Usher from Columbia has taken the lead in creating a group where we've been sharing teaching materials in the climate space in an open source way. And then there's a doctoral course that I've created with 8 others, which we're using in order to train the next generation of climate scholars.
What was your motivation to start a climate finance course and offer specifically to PhD students and offer it across business schools?
The flip answer is when I stepped down from being dean and I rejoined a faculty, I had to teach something. So that journey began with me thinking, well, you know, let me create a doctoral course for climate finance because it's something that I've begun to learn and I really want to learn more. And creating a PhD course is one way to get up to speed on the research. And so therefore, the best way to create a course is to steal it, of course, from someone else. I called up a number of colleagues in the field and everyone said the same thing. Sadly, we don't teach this course. We all know we should teach this course. We don't think we have huge enrollments for this course. I don't know if my dean would support us creating this course. It's too much work right now. And the response that I gave to them is, that's great. Why don't we all do it together? Which meant that we would collectively determine the arc of the course, what content we wanted. We would debate which papers we wanted to cover, but that we would each deliver, as it were, part of it and then benefit from everyone else. If you talk to most deans, and at this point, even though I'm not a dean anymore, I keep in touch with a lot of current deans. And they all say the same thing, that sadly, the part of business schools that seems to be the slowest in adopting climate orientation is finance. They bemoan the fact that there aren't enough faculty in their schools to teach this material. It seemed to me that if that's true, and certainly was my experience and continues to be my experience, then the way to solve that problem is either to retrain existing faculty and or to train doctoral students who, yes, time will become faculty. And so we opened up this class not only to doctoral students, but also to postdocs and current faculty. the theory of change is that in the long run, to solve this problem of changing curricula, we need to change the faculty.
I love that you took the long view.
It comes from being older.
Peter, we've spoken a lot so far about making solutions to the climate crisis part of a business school education, relevant to business schools. What about the other way around? How do we make business schools relevant to that whole process of solving the climate crisis, to be somewhere where people look for solutions first?
Tim, that is the right question. I think it speaks to how it is that we judge the success of a business school. Typically, we judge the success of a business school by how happy our students are and what academic output looks like. And those two are captured by rankings to some degree. But we also should be not only proud of, but also expect and demand that we have impact. There's a controversial point of view, and I've written about this in Times Higher Education a few years ago, that we should be thinking about our impact as schools and therefore at least considering the impact of our faculty. So how is it that we are not just writing about things, but kind of changing things? How is it that we are engaging with climate alliances? How is it that we are changing business practice? How is it that the work that we do is fundamentally altering the way that businesses think and act? And in the spirit of what we usually do, actually measuring that, going out, talking to people and saying, have we made a difference? This is probably going to be fairly hard to quantify, but it makes it no less important. Making business schools more an integral part of the climate crisis solution is quite important. I returned to Harvard in part to join the Salata Institute, which is a new institute that the university has set up around climate. And if you look at the mission of the Salata Institute, although of course we do teaching and research and support teaching and research, it's to find effective, durable, and just solutions to the problems of climate. And the solution orientation of the Salata Institute is quite important to me. And we are thinking about how it is that we, and here I use the royal we as a university, can have greater impact. Let me give you a concrete example. A few weeks ago, you might have read a news story about something called MethaneSat that launched and is in the atmosphere and is having measurements of methane. That was a project that was, to a large part, done by my colleagues here at Harvard, the scientists at Harvard who figured out how to get that satellite up and, you know, how to make sure that it did good measurements. And then other colleagues of mine at Harvard Law School were able to figure out, given those measurements, how could you incorporate those into rulemaking that was being done in the United States? As you know, from the most recent COP, there's a global methane pledge. How can we use this information in the global methane pledge? I'm sure there'll be papers that come out of that, but the fact that MethaneSat is circling the globe and the fact that the data that comes out of it is plug and play into regulatory proceedings, I think is huge impact. We have to do more of that, and business schools have to do more of that.
Faculty is often rewarded based on their research output and to some extent also on their teaching, but not so much on their impact in society. Do you think that the reward system for faculty should also change and specifically include their impact on society to incentivize business schools to do more on impact?
The short answer is yes, but there's a but. I don't think that impact can substitute for excellent teaching and excellent research. I don't think at the end of the day we should become consultants. The work that we do in academia, which gives us respect and which gives us validation and justification, is work that's based on serious research.
Right.
That research, when it's translated into action, is what we should celebrate and perhaps measure and reward. But we can't separate the impact from the underlying research. If we're simply excellent teachers, but we've created no ideas, so all we're doing is being a vessel for other people's ideas, we're probably not doing the best job that we can. At the core of either activity is idea generation, which is rigorously done, that is then delivered to students and then delivered to practice. One I would call education and the other I would call impact. And at the core of this activity is, we can call it research or idea generation or whatever. Not all of our faculty members, not all of our colleagues will be impact oriented. But for those who are, we should consider it alongside of their research and teaching.
So Peter, we want to talk to you about another one of your papers as well. This one published this year in the Harvard Business Review, how companies should weigh in on a controversy. Now, a couple of years ago, I was talking to a senior executive who was leading a team to investigate how his company should express its social values. He said, we keep coming back to the question. We sell flavored carbonated water for a profit. Why is it our business to have any opinions about how people live their lives? Why is it their business?
Well, I think two or three reasons. I spoke to a company like that some years ago and asked them what their biggest risk factor was, and it was water, access to clean water that they could use for their products. And I asked them, what are some of the issues that they face? And it was about what to do about the containers that that water or other carbonated beverage sits in. So whether they like it or not, they're a major user of a major natural resource. And whether they like it or not, they're also, by virtue of how they choose to package, having a major impact on the world. It's inherent to their business. That's just not a debatable proposition. But then what should they do about that? I mentioned earlier that my thesis advisor was Mike Jensen, and therefore, you know, I come out of the Friedman tradition of the business, business is business. But I'm also an empiricist. And I wondered, do people actually believe that? People around the world believe that that is a true statement. And we throw around words like stakeholder capitalism and shareholder capitalism. And the empiricist in me simply wanted to know, what exactly do people think we should be doing? Why is that a relevant question? Because sometimes we use the high-minded term license to operate. Our license to operate is a function of satisfying the demands of consumers and employees, of communities in which we live and more. Just seems sensible to wonder what they were thinking. And therefore, was fortunate to be able to work with Edelman, where ultimately we talked to over 75,000 people in 28 countries, asking them a number of questions about what they thought business should do.
So what did they tell you about the social responsibility of business?
The first thing that they said, and it's probably my least favorite question on the survey, is we asked them about whether firms should be more shareholder-centric or stakeholder-centric. The reason I don't like this question is I don't know that most people know what stakeholder-centric means. The question is, the primary responsibility of the corporation is to benefit all of its stakeholders to the fullest extent possible, or to maximize financial returns for its shareholders or owners to the fullest extent possible. And I think when we finally got to the 28-country sample, 77% of people, on average, across the globe, said the goal was to benefit all stakeholders to the fullest extent possible. And you might think, oh, that varies dramatically from countries like America, which is very shareholder-centric, countries like Germany. And the answer is no, not really. There's a 9-point difference between the US and Germany. There's a 6-point difference between the US and Japan. This is true in every country. We could find no country where it was less than a supermajority. So that's the beginning. The reason I was unsatisfied with that is, like I said, I don't know that most people understand what stakeholders meant. So then we went further and said, here's a list of, we didn't call them stakeholders, but here's a list of groups and which ones should get high priority. In virtually every country, the top was customers, and the next top was employees. Owners and shareholders came either last or nearly last in most countries. For example, to give you real numbers, when saying which group should be a high priority in Mexico and India, South Africa, more than 70% of people said it was customers that were high. Even in the US, that was 68%. In contrast, owners and shareholders in the US was 15 points lower. In the UK was 16 points lower. In Japan was 20 points lower. In Germany was 20 points lower. So people were making quite strong statements that said, let's first make sure we take care of customers and employees. Then we asked, if these interests conflict, then who should get top priority? Sorry to use a US expression, if there's a jump ball, that's a basketball expression, we should win. And we also gave them some other choices like it depends or none. And the answer resoundingly was customers and employees. Owners and shareholders ended up in about the same place, a little bit above suppliers, but that's about it. Across the world, people are saying that firms should be oriented around meeting the needs of customers and employees. And it's not that owners and shareholders don't have any claims upon the corporation, but they're quite secondary to the claims that are made by the primary stakeholders, which are these two that both produce products and consume these products.
How is business doing on these social challenges, like tackling climate change and alleviating social problems, supporting local communities, reskilling workers, job creation, innovation, and shareholder wealth creation, according to your survey respondents?
We did ask, what's responsibility of business? And then we did ask, how well is business doing? So we're able to do the comparison. I can describe that either at the level of the stakeholder or the level of the issue. With respect to stakeholders, you can compare these two numbers. Basically, this is important and businesses are doing well. There's a 16-point deficit. 60% of survey participants think that employees should have a high priority. Only 44% think that business is doing well. So that's a 16-point gap. A 14-point gap with respect to future generations. An 11-point gap with respect to customers. An 8-point gap with respect to communities in which they operate. There's only one area where all across the world believe that businesses are over-indexing, delivering more benefits than expected, and that is in fact to owners and shareholders, where the gap rather than being negative is positive by 8 points. So if you look at employees, future generations, customers, and communities, businesses are underperforming. According to the survey, when you look at owners and shareholders, they are overperforming. If you look at it with respect to issues, we can do the same analysis. Is this a high responsibility of business and is business doing well? There's a 47-point gap in how people in 28 countries evaluate the responsibility in business doing well with respect to working to solve world's major global problems, including climate change and poverty. What we're hearing is a pretty high level of dissatisfaction between what people believe that business can do and what it's actually doing. People understand that the primary business of business is, in fact, business. They have to create jobs and products. That was acknowledged by 85% of people as the top thing, but businesses' societal responsibilities came in a close second at 77%. So there's only an 8-point gap between what they see to be the societal responsibilities and the economic responsibilities. People are fairly optimistic that if business were to focus on these issues, they could actually have either a really big or a meaningful impact. So people are fairly optimistic and think that these social obligations are very close seconds, where the far third is geopolitical responsibilities. This is kind of nationalism. Those come in quite a bit lower than either economic or societal responsibilities.
Peter, let me take you back to that statistic about future generations, that gap, that minus 14%, we're not doing enough for future generations. How can we incorporate that into decision-making? We can't ask future generations what they want or what they think. We can't measure their experience because they haven't had it yet.
I think this is the hardest one by far. All the other stakeholders either can have voices or do have voices. For example, in the co-determination systems in Europe, you can have employees sit on boards. You can survey consumers. Future generations are, as you said, by definition, not there. And the other group that's not there are all the animals on the planet, non-sentient living things on the planet itself. Those two categories don't have a voice. And I think the important thing then is we'll talk about who we means. We have to give those other parts of society in the world of voice. I think that's where academics can do their job. I think that's where IPCC can do their job. I think that's where hard questions asked by a board can be helpful. I think that's where the question, okay, so, and maybe this doesn't get all the way, but 50 years from now, when our company is still in existence, how will we have looked back and said we've treated people over that period? I don't have a really clear answer about this. I wish I could. There is this old concept. When somebody is being proposed for sainthood, my understanding that there's someone in the room who represents the devil.
The devil's advocate.
And if in a process like that, you have somebody who plays the role of the devil, maybe we need to ask someone to come and play the role of future generation. We sometimes talk about putting young people on boards and putting young people in positions of, if not responsibility, at least to give them higher voice. They're not future generations either, but they're a lot closer to future generations than I am at my age. Giving them more of a voice may help in this process.
So why do you think this unpopular concept of shareholder primacy still prevails, despite the overwhelming majority of respondents indicating that actually firms are doing more than they expect on serving shareholder value and less than they expect on serving other social issues?
I ran an alumni session here last year, and I talked about this. And one of my former students said, "But Professor Tufano, you taught us this." And I explained how, yes, I did. And I apologized for that and said that at the time that I taught it, I actually thought it was the right thing to do. I had been taught this. I had been indoctrinated. Now we have more evidence. We have evidence not only about how it is that people around the world think about this issue, but we also have 30 or 40 years of evidence about what the implications of this practice has been for income and wealth inequality, for impacts on the planet, for the toxic impact that it's had on political processes. I think we now have a better understanding that the business of business is business, where shareholder value maximization is the rule of the land. Why that is an idea that probably we need to retire. And we should have known that, because if you go back to Adam Smith, his 1776 book, which everybody hasn't read, but they always think is all about shareholder primacy, and they really need to read the rest of the book. They've not read his 1759 book, which is The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which explains how we owe great duties to one another. So we've always been selective in how we read Adam Smith, and we also lived within a relatively narrow economic bubble. We just weren't listening to people. So why is it we continue to say things that I now believe are not to be taken on face value? Because we told each other that those were the right things to do. Quite honestly, as an economist, they were simpler. Mm-hmm. You know, we like simple analytic solutions. And the thing that we love about shareholder value maximization is it's so simple. Shareholders are the residual claimant. And therefore, as long as you maximize the value of the residual claimant, that's good for everybody. But we forgot two things. First, the first and second welfare theorems. That's only true if there are no externalities, if there's perfect information and a bunch of other things. Two, that's only true if we have a system that's able to do distribution in a way that's equitable. The first is obviously not true because the biggest externality that the world faces, which Alyssa, you've written about so eloquently in your great carbon arbitrage paper, is in fact the climate. And the second is patently true because we have not done a great job in doing redistribution of income, which is why we're seeing some of the highest levels of income inequality in modern days.
So is it a correct summary to say that the concept of shareholder primacy still prevails in part because of stickiness to the old views, but that you are perhaps confident based on the respondents of the survey that this stickiness will become less strong in its hold and over time we may actually see more of a move towards focus by business on the broader set of stakeholders and their social welfare?
So your question was, am I confident in that? And the answer is no. What I'm confident about is that it's our job to be able to teach and do research that shows that these concepts were always built on narrow sets of assumptions that are no longer shown to be true. They've had corrosive effects, and that apart from a relatively narrow set of individuals and societies, these are not held by others. Am I confident that that will change how business is done and how the connections between business and government kind of perpetuates this? I'm not yet confident about that. I'd say I'm hopeful that with evidence and with pressure, we can make sure that people are more informed, they can make better decisions in this space.
When politicians, other commentators as well, detect these changes, some of them branded as woke finance and weaponize it for political goals, what should companies do to push back against this politicization of what they want to do, expressing these social values that they have?
I do a lot of work in this space, and I'm particularly dismayed about what's going on right now. Give me an example. In January, just January of this year, a bill was proposed in New Hampshire that would make the incorporation of ESG criteria, any ESG criteria, in decisions made with state funds a felony.
Felony.
A felony.
Gosh.
Now, this was not passed, But forget about woke. The idea of somebody who manages funds for the state of New Hampshire wouldn't consider whether or not companies had good governance practices in place, whether they were involved with workplace practices that are likely going to cause rise to litigation, the fact that they were not sensitive to and not aware of the risks they were taking in climate seems to me a Neanderthal point of view. This is Risk Management 101, which is where I started my career teaching about risk management. So do we need to push back against that? Yes, there is no question about it. Are firms afraid to do that? Yes, they are. I do a lot of work in the insurance industry. The European insurance industry has been really quite forward-thinking in terms of what they need to do. The American insurance industry may think the same way, but they are afraid, as far as I can tell, to do or say anything right now, given the weaponization of these issues by largely Republican attorney generals and Republican members of the House. Your question, Tim, was should companies push back? And I think it's more than companies. I think we as academics need to push back. I think companies need to push back. Politicians need to push back. If for nothing else to say, these are real risks in society and we can't stick our head in the sand and say they're not relevant.
So in a previous Vox Talks Climate Finance podcast, we held with Dirk Schoenmaker on his new book, Corporate Finance for Long-Term Value, Dirk argued that companies should maximize integrated value, which he defines as the discounted expected future flows of financial, environmental, and social value. Do you agree with him? And do you think your respondents would agree with him that this is a good idea?
So first of all, kudos to Dirk for advancing that idea. He, along with, by the way, the Engine Number One people, which do TVM, total value, I forget what the M stands for, and my colleague here at Harvard Business School, George Serafim, who does integrated accounts, a number of people have been talking about the fact that we should start by measuring not only financial values, but the values of various positive and negative externalities. So let me start there. Should we measure these things? Absolutely. We have to be more rigorous in how we measure them, measuring them regularly, and trying wherever we can to put numbers to them, because until we measure them, we can't do anything else about them. I wholeheartedly think that companies should measure these things. Then the second question you asked is, should they maximize them? I think they should consider them, for sure. For example, in the Netherlands, under Netherlands law, firms are required to consider not only shareholder, but also customers, employees, communities, and environment. Under UK law, section, I think what's 172 of the Companies Act, says that companies are required to consider not only companies and their members, i.e. shareholders, but I think the language says with due consideration of listing a number of these other things. In both of those jurisdictions, there is already a legal responsibility to consider the measures that Dirk and others are considering. In the U.S., the law currently in most states says that companies are required and have fiduciary duties to the company and to its shareholders. And when defining the company in some law cases, it's described the company as the company in perpetuity. So I think what we need to do, rather than expecting that firms would maximize integrated value or shared value or the other measures here, is that I think we may need to change some legal rules to ensure that firms and their directors and other fiduciaries appreciate what their responsibilities are. Another battle in the United States is whether fiduciary duties exclude, and in fact, that's the basis for that New Hampshire proposed legislation, exclude consideration of these other issues. I think we have to, from a perspective of corporate governance and corporate law, make it clear, as it is in the Netherlands and to a lesser degree in the UK, that these considerations are part of the long-term fiduciary duty of corporations. Once we do that, then I think companies are in a better position to consider all these. Having said that, I think a number of forward-looking companies already appreciate that their long-term value is a function of satisfying the needs of their customers, the needs of their employees, the communities in which they operate. And they don't see this as an either-or, but as a both-and. That the long-run way to create value is to do what my former colleague at Oxford talks about as profitably solving problems of people and planet. That, I think, is an eloquent way of talking about long-run roles of business. Businesses must be profitable, but they should profit by solving problems, not by creating.
Do you feel that your survey lends some support for the notion that companies should be or would be willing to maximize integrated value, even if perhaps in the short run, including consideration of social and environmental issues, might come at the loss of financial value?
So I'd say two things. One is what we've encouraged firms to do is to not just take our word for it, but to actually ask their customers, their employees, their shareholders, what they feel about some of these important issues. They shouldn't just expect that a Harvard Business Review article will do that. We've suggested a data-oriented process they can use. And second of all, I think if they've done that, I think they might realize that those people to whom they owe the continued success of the company are actually asking them to do this. And if they do, then I think they're going to realize that these are not in opposition to one another. The hardest point will be the one that you talk about, Alyssa, which is what if the continued success, narrow success of the corporation is completely opposed to the solution of these problems? And I think you do this eloquently in your great carbon arbitrage paper. And for those of you who haven't read it, Alyssa with her colleagues have written this paper that says, you know, basically how much damage is being done by the coal industry? And is it possible that this could be solved not by taxing them, but actually paying them to stop doing what they're doing? And so we normally think of Pigouvian taxes, but there's also a Kosian solution, which is bribery. I think for the coal industry, or quite honestly, for many fossil fuel companies, they're going to find that going quietly into the night is a very difficult thing to do. And quite honestly, will be very painful for managers and shareholders. And we're going to help them make that transition.
Right.
And there are carrots and there are sticks. So I think for many companies, recognizing these factors and incorporating them in their decision making will not be painful, but in fact might be liberating to them. But there will be some firms which are going to need greater inducements. There, it may take more than simply some information from the various stakeholders.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you also to my co-host, Tim.
And to support Peter's bid for canonization, if that should ever occur, then we should mention the two Harvard Business Review articles. The first one is Galdon et al. Business schools must do more to address the climate crisis. And that is from 2022. The second one, Bersoff et al. How companies should weigh in on a controversy. And that is from 2024.
In the next episode of Vox Talks Climate Finance, we will be talking to Patrick Bolton and Timothy Lenton about climate tipping point implications for finance.